This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Radio show will have a series of silent dance parties from 8 to 10 p.m. Tuesdays in Portland parks and public spaces. That's Tuesdays from 8 to 10 p.m. For more information and this week's location, go to kboo.fm/silent dance parties.
This is Justin Miller. Join me for Between the Covers this Thursday, March 21st at 11 a.m. when my guest will be author, humorist, and man about town, Calvin Trillin, speaking about his latest book, Dogfight, the 2012 presidential campaign in verse. Calvin Trillin is the nation's deadline poet and a contributor to The New Yorker, and we'll reminisce on Mitt, Newt, Herman, Michelle, Todd, and the whole wacky gang who made the 2012 presidential campaign one for the record books. That's Calvin Trillin this week on Between the Covers, Thursday at 11 a.m. on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
Welcome to Occupy Portland Radio for March 20th, 2013. I'm Jimmy Tardy.
I'm Joe Lino.
We are glad to have you here. And again, as always, we are packing a lot of information into 1 hour. So we're going to jump right into it. Just like always, we'll be hearing a field report of Portland Rising Tide's recent ride titled Portland's Five Worst Polluters.
And we're going to hear from our new friends, Monica and Matt, an interview by Robin Ryan, and they're talking about various activist documentaries.
I was joined in the studio by former Oregon chief economist, Dr. Tom Patowski. We talked about Ron Paul's book, End the Fed.
And our buddy Joe Meyer interviewed William Daniels on reality-based economics.
All of that and some music by our new friend, a shout out to Aro Vino, hope I'm pronouncing that right, out in Ithaca, New York. We have some music provided by Aro, which we'll be highlighting on the show tonight. So let's get to it.
So this is our first stop. This is ESCO, and I wrote them a letter on behalf of all of us, so I hope it's okay. I'm going to go drop off the letter and invite them out to come hear it if they want to, and then we'll give the spiel and you can see what's up with it. Letter to ESCO today. We're going to read it outside. We're going to ask if anybody from like the public relations or anyone in upper management wanted to come hear it. Otherwise, we'll just be right out here for a few minutes, and then we'll be out of your way.
Who are you with?
We're with a ride called Portland's Worst Polluters.
How's this? Can you hear that okay? Yeah. Okay, hold on. I'm going to open the letter up real quick. We've invited them out. I don't know if they'll come or not. They seem kind of jarred. The community is here to say hello. That's all. So this is addressed to Calvin Collins, who's the president and CEO of ESCO. This is addressed to the corporate officers of ESCO and their employees.
Come on, Art.
So this is in regards to ESCO's legacy, which we've been hearing a lot about in the news lately, and their place in our community. And this is on behalf of our ride and the community at large. ESCO, we've come to see you today because, quite frankly, you're a terrible excuse for a community member and one of Portland's worst polluters. Ethan? You want? That's fine.
You've been polluting the local environment for quite some time. As it turns out, 35 Portland area schools are in the top 5% of national schools with the most dangerous exposure to air toxins. 7 of these schools in Northwest Portland can thank you, ESCO Steel, for being the number one source of pollution, including heavy metal toxins like lead, manganese, arsenic, and chromium-6. Apparently not content with harming just those in your immediate geographical area, you've recently become heavily invested in tar sands extraction, coal mining, exports, and fracking for natural gas, while staking your future on building vital, mission-critical enabling equipment for all three, particularly drill bits, which wear out quickly and need frequent replacement. In case you've forgotten what these activities do to landscapes, we brought some visual aids, and I think Greg has those. I threw a bunch of cards and placards. Where's Greg?
Over there.
Yeah, on the, do you see that red cape on those thingies right there? Greg, hey, stop. Those cards right there.
Sorry.
So we can pass those around so people can kind of get a, they have sarcastic images. One of ESCO's slogans is innovation. They put it on everything. And so these placards are some examples of ESCO's innovation. So that you've chosen to invest so heavily in fossil fuel extraction at a time when climate change threatens the entire planet is reprehensible. I say chosen, of course, because this massive investment in fossil fuel extraction technologies is the result of recent company decisions. You could have easily gone the route of producing parts for renewable energy technologies. This type of investment would have made you an asset to your community. Instead, you chose to profit off the most dangerous, ecologically destructive, and antiquated activities possible and pay public relations firms money to greenwash your corporate image with celebratory exhibits at the Oregon Historical Society, for example. We'll visit them later. ESCO, you are an archetype of disaster capitalism. It's clear that you'll harm anything or anyone to make a buck. If we lived in a saner time, this type of activity would be criminal. You do not represent the values of the community you live in, and your business activities are a threat to those around you and the ability of future generations to exist on a livable planet. Your concerns for life clearly extend only as far as your profit margin. You are climate profiteers of the worst sort. However, your community is now acutely aware of your awful activities. Today, we pledge loudly and relentlessly to tell the truth about your recklessness and oppose any attempts of yours to greenwash your extraction nightmare of a company until either you collapse under the weight of your own terrible choices or invest in the future. We're going to make a household name out of you, ESCO, where any association with your brand comes with a huge political cost. We are committed to stopping you from profiting off of the destruction of the planet. So, and I just wanted to say, one of the reasons why we took the route around there is so everybody had to experience that at least once up front, because that's the that gets all around in our community every day. Terrible, terrible air quality in this city, and we have places like ESCO to thank. So, shall we go to the next worst polluter? All right, let's jack the music up and continue the ride.
So he was remarking about the air quality as he rode around the plant.
What did you think of the air as you're...
Stinks. And I'm really sensitive to chemicals. So I'm going to know. It's really bad over here. I have a friend that lives in an assisted living facility, and it's pretty close to here. And yeah, she can't help where she lives. She has to breathe the all the time, and she's got fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue. And you top that with ESCO's bullshit in the air, it's not good.
All right. How's everyone doing? Great. So we're right here outside of Guard Communications. They're a PR lobbying firm based out of Portland. The reason that we are biking to Guard Communications on our tar sands and fossil fuels profiteers day of action is they are the company that have chosen to represent Amber Energy, an Australian coal company that is proposing not one, but two coal export terminals in the Northwest. So they came to Longview, Washington, proposing a $5.7 million coal export terminal. Internal documents shortly after their permits were entered into the system revealed that they didn't want to export 5.7 million, they wanted to export 60 million tons. They lied to the county, they lied to the citizens of Longview because they didn't think that what they were doing was ethical. They thought that They thought it would be easier to put in a 5.7 million ton permit and then flip it into a 60 million ton permit. They lied to the city of Longview. Right. And now, the drama unfolds in Oregon. Coal export, Amber Energy's Morrow Pacific coal export proposal is the farthest along out of all five coal export proposals. There was a permit decision that was set for April 1st by the Department of State Lands. That permit decision has been delayed until September 1st, which is good. But here's how this went down. Department of State Lands sent a letter to Amber Energy saying, "This is not an average proposal. We need these XYZ documents." Amber Energy replied, "No, you don't. Coal is a typical, normal commodity. We don't need to do those extra studies that you have asked of us." The state replied, "Yes, you do." Amber Energy finally complied, saying, "Okay, give us 5 more months and we'll see what we can do." So we're in that 5 month period right now. And now what we're seeing all over the news is Guard Communications speaking on behalf of Amber Energy, saying it's unfair that we're being treated differently from any other commodity. Is coal a regular commodity? No, that shit's toxic. Got toxic lead, mercury, and arsenic, and they want to put it through the Columbia River. So what I have with me is coal that I actually collected from the Columbia River Gorge, from the few coal trains that go through a day up to the Centralia Power Plant and an export terminal in BC. And this is what Guard wants to bring to the Columbia River Gorge. And so we're going to bring that back to Guard today. Is there anyone here that would like to accompany my good friend Michael in delivering this back to Guard Communications? Come on up, we're doing it now. We're just gonna do a quick drop.
Guard bikes!
Is Mr. Garden?
No.
Okay. Well, we have a present. Hey, are you Liz Fuller? Are you Liz Fuller?
Sorry, you need to leave.
My name's Michael.
Please, you're not allowed to record anything.
Yeah, we're just gonna be here for just a minute. No, I have a present. For you. Hey, Mr. God, my name's Michael. How you doing?
It's time to go.
I have a present for you.
It's time to go. This is a private company. It's time
to go. Right,
we're
just saying hey.
It's time to go.
We're just saying hey. We just wanted
to
congratulate you on your
this is unnecessary.
On your
Come
failure
on.
To
this is unnecessary.
To bring coal.
It's actually
Columbia.
Really necessary, sir. Yeah. Someone's got to do it.
Enjoy the coal.
Yeah.
Because that's about all that's going to make it down here. All right.
Have
Best
fun,
of
guys.
Luck to you.
Have
fun.
Oh,
don't consider. Frankly, I'm happy that you're representing me, because anybody else might do a decent job. You know what? I don't mind taking the stairs. You have a lovely day. Like
you too.
Say,
never too late to change your ways.
Do what you want.
You do realize you're killing children.
I mean, it is too late at a certain point.
You are killing us.
You have to.
That's why we are here. We are not here because we don't like you.
Get
we
out.
Are here because we want to live.
Get out.
We want to live.
Get out
we
now.
We want to live.
I would love to
Get
leave.
Out
we
now.
We want to live. We
We're
want
leaving,
you to live.
Sir.
Get out now.
Please don't kill us. Thank you. See you later.
Hey, do the right thing.
It makes no difference, 'cause money talks. But if you don't listen, something is missing. Money has no mercy, it makes no exceptions to the rule. Family too. D.C. And some of it goes to Albany. Don't forget Social Security. Whatever's left goes to me, so I can pay my utilities, my rent, my car, nothing's free, excepting for the best things in life, which of course go to the birds and bees. Money owns me.
The library was always a favorite tent, and this segment of Occupy Portland Radio celebrates that spirit. Here's 10 minutes on reality-based economics by William Daniels.
Hi, my name is William Daniels, and I'm here to share spectacular economic news with you that's mostly unnoticed in our preoccupation with jobs and earning a living and money and debt, and to share a spectacular opportunity to have a much higher standard and quality of life for every single human being on this planet, to free up our time, to allow us more choice as to what we do in life, what we do with our time, and to make economics easy to understand. Right now, we are living in the golden age of productivity. We produce enough food to feed all humanity, all 7 billion of us, even though 20 million people starve to death each year. The United States has just under 19 million vacant apartments and houses and 3.5 million homeless people. So we have 5 vacant housing units for every homeless person, and we can't solve homelessness. If I said to you, you know, it's really not possible to produce enough tongue depressors and stethoscopes and X-ray machines and hospital beds and MRI machines. It's not possible to train enough medical personnel to take care of everyone. I hope you would say to me, William, you're out of touch. Of course it's possible to do these things. Well, why aren't we doing them then? Well, at the bottom line, people that are starving don't have enough money. People that are homeless don't have enough money. People that don't have access to health care don't have enough money. We either do produce enough for everyone, or we can produce enough for everyone, and we don't do it. Right around the year 1900, there were a few thousand people who were the richest, most powerful people on the planet. Kings, queens, heads of international businesses. Not one of them could flip a switch to get clean, safe light, speak instantaneously with their top generals, governors, managers in the field, hear and see events happening live in other parts of the world, travel 300, 400, 500 miles in a single day using a vehicle sitting at their residence, fly to a place where they wanted to vacation, process data rapidly, access large amounts of all the information known to man from their desktop. Now, only 113 years later, humans have harnessed electricity, invented telephones, radio, televisions, moving pictures, automobiles, airplanes, computers, and the internet. Not only have we invented and done all of these, we invented the moving assembly line, which greatly accelerated mass production, such that these goods and services are available to a rapidly growing portion of all humanity. Seen in the context of all human history, this is a stunning accomplishment. We don't realize the importance of this, because we pay attention to the money values we assign to things rather than the underlying capability to produce and distribute goods and services, which for practical purposes is unlimited. Humans have successfully invented machines to do our jobs for us. Then we turn right around and as a culture we say we want full employment. As individuals, when we get replaced by a machine, we say we want another job. And my question is, why? Why don't we want our time? Can't we figure out things to do with our time? How about raising children on a full-time basis? It used to be that one parent would go out and earn money, and the other parent would stay home and raise the children and manage the household. Now it's much more common for both parents to go out and work, pay someone else to do part of the child care. Self-defeating, isn't it? Why is this contradiction not a matter of public awareness and discussion? We are very thoroughly conditioned to look at life through the lens of money and finance. And we don't ask simple questions like, is there a better system than money and finance to manage our lives, to manage economic activity? In the work I do, I make a distinction between economics and money and finance. We almost never do. We use those words interchangeably. I heard Obama speak, and he used those two words in one sentence, referring to one thing. It is possible to separate them out and look at them independently. And when we do, it's pretty remarkable what we can see. Economics, by the simplest definition, is the production, distribution, and use of goods and services. Well, what's money? Money is a management tool. It's how we determine who gets access to goods and services and how much access. Finance is a management system. And if we ask a really simple question, how well is the management system doing? You have to say terrible. We produce enough food for everyone, and 20 million people starve to death. We've got enough housing in the United States, and we have 3.5 million homeless people. We can certainly provide health care. Technically, we have the ability to do it, and we don't do it for about 40 to 50 million people. So economics looks at what is the need and what is the capability of meeting the need, period. And we match them up. If we don't have enough capability, then we can develop that. We have clearly shown that we can produce goods and services on a virtually unlimited basis. So if we aren't currently producing enough of any particular thing, we can ramp that up and do it. What we do now, though, by looking through the lens of money and finance, we don't see that we have the ability to produce goods and services. We say, well, we don't have enough money. Well, how's that been working for us? There was a report in the New York Times August 19th of 2009, a reporter, Edmund Andrews, interviewed a number of economists regarding Ben Bernanke and the bailout. This is what Edmund Andrews wrote. But economists say Mr. Bernanke's most important accomplishment was to create staggering amounts of money out of thin air. That's a very revealing statement that he made. It tells us not only that Ben Bernanke created staggering amounts of money out of thin air, it told us where all money comes from. We create it out of thin air. Let's stand back and take a look for a moment. We can see clearly we didn't find money growing out of the ground or on any kind of trees or bushes. Money didn't fall from the skies. We made it up 100%. When Mr. Bernanke created staggering amounts of money, he used that money to save the financial system. He did not use that money to save housing for people who were being foreclosed. He didn't use it to provide food for people who were hungry. He used it to save the system. So we can see that the financial system is not designed to meet human needs. That's a secondary thing. We meet human needs after we make money. Economics, again, is designed to look strictly at what is the need, what is the capability of meeting the need. The condition on planet Earth is abundance. Now, that doesn't mean that we have an unlimited supply of any and every particular thing. Usefully understood, abundance is a condition or a state in which results can be produced that are sufficient to fulfill all needs indefinitely. In that state, there's no waste. Everything is recycled. All aspects of the environment are maintained in the most pristine condition possible. Let's look at the fundamental principles of money. The fundamental operating principle of money, when we get right down to the bottom line, is what I can control, you cannot have. I'm going to withhold it from you unless you give me something that I value equally or more. I want to make a profit, so I want you to give me something that I value more than what I'm giving you. So it's control and withholding from. If we stand back a moment and look at the universe, we can see that the universe produces stuff, the universe distributes stuff, the universe uses stuff. The universe, it turns out, is a gigantic economy. It's easy to see that the fundamental operating principle of the universe is sharing with freely. The universe has never charged human beings for anything, ever. Everything's here for free. And even now, nobody has come to us and sent a bill for the air we breathe or the sunshine we soak up. So we can see that the fundamental operating principle of the universe and the fundamental operating principle of money are completely opposite. They are incompatible with each other.
For more on reality-based economics, go to the KBOO website and search on William Daniels or reality-based economics. And this is Joe Meyer from the Occupy Library Tent.
It's what everyone should get. It's what it takes to make it through. 'Cause the minimum won't do. If you're gonna make ends meet, put clothes on your back, shoes on your feet, pay the mortgage or the rent. The money before it's spent. A living wage. A living wage. A living wage. A living wage. Pay the mortgage or the rent. Pay the mortgage.
I probably project a little bit more than Monica does.
It's that masculinity thing?
Well, that, and I'm very loud and talkative, so.
Well, you definitely need to come to our next rally then.
Most definitely.
This is Robin Ryan for Occupy Radio, and I'm talking with Matt Brockman and Monica Andrade. They are fresh in town, Puddleton, I like to call it. from the Chicago area, and they've been here about a month?
Yes.
And you guys have an interesting way of spending your time. You review documentaries about social movements. How many have you taken in how long a period of time?
Oh, that's really hard to say. I think we actually try to watch one new film a day, whether it's documentary or otherwise. And I've been watching documentaries since I was probably in junior high, so.
And you're hoping tonight to talk about some specific films?
Yes. We have three that we want to touch on. The main one being Bringing Down a Dictator by Steve York and Do Not Treat Us Like Animals. And finally, Burma Vijay.
So the first one, I guess, which is our main highlight, is Bringing Down a Dictator, which focuses on the student revolution in Serbia. It was around 2000. It pretty much encompasses around a group of students who called themselves Otpor, which is in Serbian, it stands for resistance. It's actually a pretty trying and wonderful tale with a very great outcome.
The whole documentary is about these students coming together to try to topple his regime. And the point where it was September 24th, I believe, of 2000, they held the elections and he lost and tried to hold a second election. That's when the whole country kind of broke out in revolt. Miners, bus drivers, students everywhere, they all came out and protested, and eventually he stepped down and resigned. So they were successful in ending his regime.
And for folks wanting to catch it, can you give them some information about how they can go about doing that?
You can catch all of the films that we're mentioning today at filmsforaction.org.
Yeah, it's a wonderful little site with a great search query system where you can find a lot of informational documentaries and just a lot of other great shorts.
Pretty solid streaming as well. There wasn't any lag when we visited the site. The next film we wanted to talk about is Do Not Treat Us Like Animals. This film focuses on a group of youths in the suburbs of Sweden, and they're fighting specifically for a youth center to reopen, but on a broader spectrum, they're fighting for the rights of the youth in the suburbs. They're kind of facing the same problems that the inner cities of the United States are facing, which, you know, is just larger police state, cameras being thrown up on the corner instead of preventative actions to keep youth busy and educated. The inner city receives all of the best education while the suburbs are kind of pushed under the rug and targeted as criminals. So the whole story is about this group of students that kind of have come together to try to fight for the rights of their generation and the generations below them.
And do you have a time frame on when that was filmed?
Yeah, that was actually, it was released as of last year, so it's a very new documentary, and I know it's not very well known, and you can find that as well on filmsforaction.org. I would definitely suggest watching it because it really hits home. It's just, I guess, there's a lot of interconnectivity between these Swedish youths and the youths of the United States and the youth all over Europe. I believe it's just a very great film.
A lot of times I think the youth, not just in Sweden, obviously, but in all countries, are oftentimes underestimated. And it's great to see a group of kids that are coming together, and they're very educated with, you know, with the political system and how it works. And they call out the members of the city council various points during the film. And it's pretty great to see that as much as they've been pushed down and made out to be uneducated criminals, drug addicts, and all of that, they still are very intelligent, and they show it. It shows. So I think it's a great, great film.
The third film is Burma Vijay, and it's a very trying tale of the Burmese people and their struggle with their oppressive, militaristic dictatorship. It focuses around the DVB, which is the Democratic Voice of Burma. They are guerrilla video journalists who are trying to counteract the propaganda of the military regime. And it pretty much documents the Saffron Revolution of 2007. It takes focus around their nonviolent revolution.
With the first two films, obviously the most common thing tying them together is the fact that it's a youth group, or not a youth group, but a group of youths. So in the first one, it was a bunch of students. In the second one, it's actually, I think they're more high school aged than. In the first one, it's college-aged students, and in Do Not Treat Us Like Animals, they're junior high school age. And in Burma Vijay, of course, it starts, the secret reporters are just trying to get the word out there, and they're actually doing true journalism as opposed to, you know, private media that you see oftentimes today. But of course, there's a group of monks that protest. There are a group of students there. So I think amongst the three documentaries, what ties them together is just hope that things can change for the better. I would say between Bringing Down a Dictator and Burma Vijay, there's also the right to speak out, because in Serbia, it wasn't as, it's nowhere near as isolated as Burma, but there was a lot of action being taken to stifle independent media, to stifle any kind of non-government groups or organizations, stifle any kind of group that was opposing the government, obviously. In Burma, it was much more isolated. I mean, the level of oppression in Burma just far supersedes anything that I've seen. But in both of them, one of the main things is just trying to be able to actually speak your mind and not be afraid of what happens to you for doing so.
I would say, of course, not on a much more outwardly oppressive scale, as far as, you know, in Burma, just the massacre of the people that went on. I mean, even though as of today, it's lightened up a lot, it's still an oppressive military dictatorship. But I do believe that through the Occupy movement, there is still a lot of repression and silencing going on, a lot of voices being unheard. And I think it's just reaching a boiling point where it's going to continue to spread, and more people are just going to get fed up. Their voices aren't being heard.
And I would say the important thing, too, looking at these documentaries, especially when in the ones in which progress has been made or resolution has been found to some extent, the important thing is to really come together and not to back down. Because I think that with the Occupy movements, what was great about it is that they sprung up all across the country and around the globe, really. And if people kind of come together to keep pushing forward instead of kind of falling apart in their own little corners of the country or of the world until we're all tired out, I think that would be a pretty good formula for success. It's just making sure we stick together and that we don't tire ourselves out and give up.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much for having us. It's great.
And just to re-plug it, to get access to all these documentaries and more, check out filmsforaction.org.
Thanks for coming. One more time, that is filmsforaction.org. You've been listening to Occupy Radio. I'm Robin Ryan.
So I started to sniff around, and I mean, he's making some basic claims. And it doesn't seem to be that complicated to me. And so I thought, well, how can this be that straightforward? It doesn't seem possible, for instance. And, you know, I went on the Fed's website,
yeah,
and tried to get their response to such things as, is the Fed privately owned, for instance?
Right.
And their answer was almost kind of a non-answer, like we're a unique entity that's independent within the government and all this. And I'm just like, what does that mean?
Well, you know, Jimmy, I think it really came all the way back, you know, in the 1800s when we tried to have a national bank for the U.S. Actually, it was, I think, 1791 was the first bank of the United States.
Uh-huh.
They gave it a 20-year charter. Nobody liked it. They revoked the charter after 20 years.
Right.
Then there was a couple financial crises. They tried it again. The second bank of the U.S. Once again, after 20 years, its charter was revoked. So we had a lot of aspects. There was a National Banking Act in around 1860s. They call it the free banking era. States were issuing their own notes. A lot of confusion. And a lot of people not happy about it. And these periodic major financial crises. One really bad one in 1907. So we had Woodrow Wilson get elected, Democrat. They really pushed through this Federal Reserve Act of 1913. And the way they kind of did it was there was this distrust against a central bank that oversaw everything. And they wanted something that was more decentralized than a whole central bank. So you come up with this weird system of a sort of board of governors that oversees things, and these 12 regional Federal Reserve banks.
Right.
It's sort of this centralized, decentralized makeup.
So they, and I've read something where they said that that mechanism was kind of there so that they could get more of a an insight from, rather than a centralized body, representation from the entire country.
Yeah, and they do that. Each of the regional Federal Reserve banks put out what they call these blue books, where they say, in our region, here's what we're seeing. So there's feed into it, but you know, in my mind, for all practical purposes, it's a centralized national bank.
Let's assume that you could have a central bank that was a public entity that was owned by the country. Is centralized banking necessarily, is it necessarily not in our best interest to do that?
Oh, I think it is in our best interest to have a central national bank. You know, think about if every state had their own currency. Do you have exchange rates between states?
Right.
All this really helps interstate commerce. And I think it overall helps the economy. And you have basically someone that's somewhat in control of the money supply that happens to the economy. Now, I think it's when you get in trouble, when countries get in trouble, is when there is a close connection between the government and politicians and their central bank. Because here you can have people come in that want to spend a lot of money, which is okay. If the way they do it is to say, they call down the street to their central bank and say, look, we have this program, you print up the money, we're going to spend it. And then you can get economies into hyperinflation situations there, and they get into trouble.
Okay.
So I think it's good to divorce the monetary policy from the politicians.
Anybody could probably understand that political control over the money would be a bad thing, just because you couldn't really trust the value of that dollar anymore.
I think that's right. That's right. And you know, it's not, you know, the politicians want to be able to do things. They're looking for ways to accomplish things. And unfortunately, I think if they had control over the money supply, I think that would overall hurt the economy in the long run.
What if it's, and this seems to be kind of what Representative Ron Paul is getting at, that it's actually the other way around, that the people who are in control of the money supply are calling the shots. And you got any thoughts on that?
You want to say, well, who is controlling the money supply? And there's all sorts of theories out there that it is the private financial institutions, J.P. Morgan or something like that, who's calling up the Federal Reserve and telling them what policies to do. Now, I'm not in that camp. I believe that, you know, there's pluses and minuses. I think with an independent Federal Reserve, you have people that aren't going to be influenced by politics because they're insulated from it. They, I think, do have the best interests of the economy in mind. Maybe some of the economic theories aren't the best ones, but the best that we have to work with, that's what they're using. I think right now, if you consider what is happening in our federal government with the U.S. Congress, and we're limping along in a recovery here, and actual federal spending, which in my mind should be a little up still, because we're still struggling and trying to recover, they are deadlocked. And if it wasn't for, I think, the Federal Reserve policies right now, we could have slipped back into recession.
What do you think about people who criticize what they call easy money? Do you think now, as we're structured, we're in an easy money economy? What does that phrase mean to you?
The easy money economy generally means that the money supply is growing a lot faster than, say, the economy is growing.
Okay.
And that banks are really flush with cash. They could loan it out at almost any time. And, for example, not to get too technical, but there's a thing called excess reserves.
Sure.
Banks are holding more than they need to hold by
right,
law.
Right.
That's usually almost a zero number because nobody pays them interest on holding cash.
Right.
But excess reserves now are over $1 trillion. At this moment, where before 2008, it was almost zero. And banks can kind of, they can multiply, lend things out, They can take $1 trillion and turn that into 10 trillion loan. And so there's the possibility right now that we could get into a very high inflationary state. And the people that are against the easy money policy right now are those people. They're very concerned that all of a sudden the banks will start loaning out like crazy. There's not enough economic activity relative to this money being released into the system. When it's in excess reserves, it's just held. It's not part of our circulating economy.
Right.
But it could become at a multiple of 10.
Right.
And once that happens, we could get inflation. Now, there's consequences from these actions. Now I've got all this stuff out there. How do I slowly clean it up? So the real trick, and the people that are worried about the easy money, is that they don't believe the Federal Reserve, once the economy gets a little stronger, that they'll be able to silk that money back out of the system at just the right rate to not cause inflation and yet not cut off the recovery. If they soak it out too fast, that may cause interest rates to rise quite quickly, because then there's less cash and money out there to loan out. So the limited supply of credit has a higher interest to it. And that higher interest slows down spending. Think about people buying cars, people buying houses,
right,
whatever, you know, if it loaning starts to slow down. And so that could cause a slower economic activity.
Okay.
So, but there's a right sweet point to, because if you don't take it out and the money supply really gets multiplied and used too strongly out there, well, you'll get inflation. And that can be just as bad as having too little money supply.
So in Ron Paul's book, End the Fed, the last chapter, returning again to the theme, the unique power the Fed possesses is the power to inspire and support the creation of new money out of nothing. He says, who needs that? Banks like it. Government likes it. High-flying financiers like it. But the people do not benefit, just the reverse. A lesson taught by classical economists that remains true is there's no ideal supply of money in a society. Any quantity of money will do so long as the quality of the money is sound. How does that relate to our money situation right now? Is our money sound?
The soundness of money is based on people's willingness to use it. The soundness is kind of related to the confidence that people have of using that as a form of currency and a form of a medium of exchange. And that by that definition, our money is sound. Now, by another definition, what is the value of the money in terms of, as prices start to go up, you know, the money that you have buys less. And in that sense, we have had some problems in the 70s, I mean, in the 80s. But more recently, the inflation has been relatively low. So I think by that standard, the money is okay. I guess I have trouble with Ron Paul's possible definition of what he means by quality of money.
So he provides in the beginning of his book, The Origin and Nature of the Fed. He starts out as of January 1913, pegging the dollar at being worth $1.
Yeah.
And this graph on page 25, does this graph seem reasonable and sound to you? If you remember that essentially the buying power of the dollar over the last century has gone from a dollar to, oh, that looks like about 3 cents.
About 3 cents, that's probably right.
5 cents.
Yeah, 5 cents. So what matters to us is, let's say, you know, so if it's 5 cents, I'm trying to think of multiples here. If it was 10 cents, then $1 back in 10 dollars would work today, I believe.
Sure.
It's 10 cents. So if we're looking at five, we're looking at what, $20?
$20.
So if I was making a dollar in 1913, and if today I'm making $20, I'm at the same point. So what we have to look at is, this is the value of the dollar's gone down. You need another graph to say, well, what have money incomes done over the same period? Because, you know, because it's the buying power of the dollar may have gone down, but if my money income, not adjusted for inflation, money income has gone up 20 times, the dollar value dollar has gone down 20 times, but my money income has gone up 20 times, I'm just as well off.
Okay.
Maybe my wallet's a little fatter because I have to carry more bills than just $1 bill. But other than that, I'm okay. So I think the real heat graph he should look at is what's happening to real incomes over time. And actually, the story is kind of tough on this because as you start to look, as we get into the 1980s, real incomes for sort of, let's call it the middle income category of distribution of income of people, has kind of stayed pretty flat. It hasn't really gone up. Where what we'd like to see in society is real incomes rise over time. And unfortunately for the higher income group, it has risen over time. But for the medium income and lower income groups actually they has probably fallen a little bit. So in that sense, that's more of a, I think, a historically a more recent phenomenon than going back to 1913. Really about the mid-1980s to now, that's been a kind of conundrum of what's been happening in the U.S. And I don't, and I wouldn't necessarily say that the federal...
Corporate greed will not feed the masses. We want the 1% out on their assets. Institutions, they are the problem, not the solution. Not the military industrial complex. Health insurance, it's indisputable. They are ripping us off.
That's Arovino. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Out of Ithaca, New York, we received a CD in the mail from Aro. I thought we'd highlight her since the subject matter is very germane to what we were talking about on the show. So what you just listened to was a piece that Joe Meyer did interviewing or basically just letting William Daniels kind of talk about his take on reality-based economics and making this distinction between economics and money. And they are two very different things, as he was highlighting to us. We also talked with our new friends Monica and Matt, and that little piece about some documentaries that we want to encourage you to go check out was facilitated by Robin Ryan, who is now a new part of the Occupy Portland Radio team. We welcome her. At the end there, we were talking with Dr. Tom Potowski, who is the former chief economist for the state of Oregon, and he is currently the chair of the economics department at Portland State University. And that whole discussion was kind of sparked off by, going back to the Occupy encampment and something that was called OccuCards. I don't know if any of you out there recall seeing those, but they were critical of the Federal Reserve and some of its manipulations of the money supply. So that led me to start to do some nosing around on my own. And I went to the Federal Reserve website and didn't really find any answers there that satisfied me. So I decided, okay, who's the number one voice speaking out against the Federal Reserve? And that was the quote-unquote Tea Party favorite, Ron Paul, libertarian, former representative out of Texas, who just recently retired from Congress. And one of the final swipes that he tried to take at the Fed was an act that he had titled audit the Fed. It did not pass in Congress. So we're left in a situation where the powers that control our money supply are kept secret from us. We don't know who they are, and they are not accountable to us for their actions in manipulating the money supply in the United States. So I started to read his book, End the Fed, and then Dr. Patowski was nice enough to come to the studio and talk to me, clarify some of the points in there, and shed some light, at least, on the Federal Reserve. And then we also heard a recording of the Portland's Top 5 Polluters ride, which was conducted by Portland Rising Tide. That was on Monday. They visited Esco Corporation and Guard PR firm, among others. And that was what we were listening to there. I want to thank Kurt Lauer. I want to send some thanks out to Dalton Kupker, Joe Meyer, Joe Lino, our friends Monica and Matt, and Robin Ryan. Also, of course, Dr. Tom Patowski and William Daniels for their help and assistance with the show today. I'm Jimmy Tardy for Occupy Portland Radio. Remember, Occupy.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, also heard around the web at www.kbu.fm. Up next is Hard Knock Radio.
I beg your pardon.
After 12 years of marriage, my husband went to prison. Listen how we kept our love alive on Prison Pipeline on April 8th.
The key to keeping our love alive was communication, right, Sharon?
When did that happen, honey?
Oh, weren't we communicating on a regular basis?
Is that what you call it?
And the communication continues. I guess you'll just have to listen to Prison Pipeline to hear the rest of the story. That's Prison Pipeline, April 8th at 6:30 p.m.
I beg your pardon. I never promised you a rose garden.
Fifty years ago, carrying only a tape recorder and a microphone, Chris Strachowicz started a journey that would bring regional roots music to the rest of America and to the world. Join me, Phil G., and my co-host, Alicia Olson, on Saturday, March 30th, as we bring you a five-hour special celebrating 53 years of Chris and his label, Arhuli Records, and the music that has been brought to us. From Tejano border music to Cajun and Zydeco styles, from Mississippi and Texas blues to San Francisco folk and jug bands, Arhuli recorded it and brought it to the world. Tune in Saturday, March 30th, from 2 to 7 p.m. as we celebrate the music of Arhuli Records here on listener-powered 90.7 KBOO.
March 6th, 2013, Station Navigator Report. Thanks to a great partnership with Portland Community Media, you can now watch KBOO on television. So check out Buscando America, which airs on March 11th, Channel 11, at 10 p.m. Thanks, PCM, for this great opportunity. On April 6th, the ending day for the spring drive, we will be at the Hollywood Bowl from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Bowling, food, bands, and an on-location broadcast. You won't want to miss it. So please tune in during the membership drive. Make a financial donation to KBOO and help keep KBOO on the air. Your donation financially supports KBOO, but it also makes you a voting member. And this is really the most valuable thing KBOO can offer you, a stake in our future. I am available for questions, ideas, and concerns. Please email me at navigator@kboo.org. Thanks.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.